I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk with Jane Mayer. She's a writer for the New Yorker magazine. Her recent piece about Vice President of the United States Mike Pence may be the most comprehensive look at the former Indiana governor's life and career yet published. She also is the author of, among other books, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Our email is nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. Today on No Limits, we're going to be talking with Jane Mayer. She's a writer for The New Yorker. Her recent piece about Vice President of the United States Mike Pence, former Indiana Governor Mike Pence, is probably the most comprehensive look at Pence's life and career so published so far. She also is the author of, among other books, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Jane Mayer, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
It's good to have you here. And I should say to our listeners, if you want to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. Our email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI, and Twitter is WFYI. So, Jane, I want to start because I'm always fascinated about how pieces like this take shape. And what I'd like to know is how much did you know about Mike Pence before you started to do the reporting on this?
Well, actually, very little, I have to say. And it was an unusual piece for me in that most stories are suggested by the reporters at The New Yorker, but this one came down as an assignment from my editor. There was a sense that Mike Pence could be president someday and we should take a close look at him. So they asked me to do that. So it just was kind of an assignment. And all I knew was, you know, just a few things about him, including that because I'd written a book about the big dark money in the country, particularly that from the Koch brothers, Charles and David Koch, I knew that he had been a favorite of theirs and that they had hoped in 2012 that he would run for president. And I never knew why he was a favorite of theirs particularly. And so anyway, that's pretty much, I just started from scratch. And part of the reporting, I must have interviewed 60 people, but part of the reporting was coming to Indiana, which I really enjoyed.
What surprised you the most about, because in some ways you've got a chance to dive into this public figure's life, and in many ways, I think we here in Indiana obviously know a fair bit about Mike Pence, but for the rest of the country, he's still something of a cipher.
So I thought that my sense of him was that he was an ideologue, a kind of a very, very strong Christian conservative, one of the most far right wing ones in the country, and that this was very, very important to him. And what I guess I hadn't reckoned on was how intensely ambitious he was also, and that these two sides of him would be sort of in tension from time to time, so that he would be, you know, pushing himself forward somewhat, even at the expense, some people would argue, of his Christian beliefs. And I think one of the most powerful interviews I did in the story was with former Archbishop Tobin of Indianapolis, who is now a cardinal and in New Jersey, and who really took exception to at least one of the policies that positions Pence took, but where Pence was turning away Syrian refugees from Indiana that were going to be settled there, Archbishop Tobin, you know, I said to him finally, well, is there a Christian rationale for the position that then Governor Pence took, and he just sort of he just kind of waited for a second, and then there was silence, and then he said no. And so I, you know, you could see that there were political positions that Pence took, maybe at the expense of his faith at some points, in order to get ahead. And I thought that was kind of unexpected to me.
What were the hardest pieces of the Pence story to nail down to get?
Well, I was interested in the money trail. Mm-hmm. I was trying to figure out, he's an interesting politician in that he has almost no money even still, mm-hmm. by himself. I mean, he's every now and then his campaign disclosures have shown, I think at one point that he had a grand total of $4,000 and one more recently was $15,000. But yet he's run fairly lavishly financed campaigns. So who was financing him? And what I found out was it was the Kochs in part, and they run a kind of an unparalleled political machine these days that's filled with money from billionaires like themselves and multi-millionaires who are corporate and have huge industrial and corporate interests. And they've really bankrolled Pence at many steps in his career. So following that money was hard, and trying to figure out the money right in Indiana, which is a state I don't pretend to be an expert in, was also interesting. And I found it interesting that among the powerful financial backers in the state of Indiana were the casinos, which don't give money directly to candidates by Indiana law, but do give money to soft money groups such as the Republican Governors Association, which then gave a ton of money to Pence. So the money was wiggling through a kind of a arduous path, but kind of making its way back, it appeared to me.
You mentioned, obviously, the Koch brothers. And I've got to say, I'm a tremendous admirer of your book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind Rise of the Radical Right. I think it was one of the best books I've read in recent years, in some ways one of the most disturbing ones, because we see in it the rise of this whole political structure that very few people are aware of.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I mean,
You're welcome.
You know, I mean, I used to be a reporter before I went to the New Yorker for the Wall Street Journal. So following business and trying to trace money has been something I've been doing for a lot of my adult life here. So, and I live in Washington and follow politics. And truthfully, you can't really cover politics adequately unless you follow the money, because it's just playing such a big role in it these days.
Well, and the other part of it, though, that impressed me is that it's a billionaires club, obviously, and fairly exclusive on those grounds alone. But I'd like to talk about, how you managed to penetrate that world, because as I read the book, it couldn't escape my awareness that in many ways it was very much an old boys club, too. There are some women who are involved, but by and large, the drivers, the Koch brothers, the other major players that they assemble in some ways are like late 19th century plutocrats. How did you manage to gain entree into that world so that you could report about it with such intimacy and authority?
Well, it took 5 years and lots of begging. What can I say? I'm a reporter, so you just call up everybody you know, and when you finally get somebody to talk to you, you ask who else to talk to. And then, you know, the thing is that money pays for things. And so even though they're not public filings that let you see the money, you can see the ads on TV, and you can see the organizations that are sponsoring the ads, and then you can sort of try to trace back who's behind those organizations. I mean, there's a lot of sort of phony baloney that you just keep picking up the rocks and turning them over and finding the creepy crawly things underneath them. So it was actually kind of fun. It was, like being a sort of amateur sleuth for a few years watching it. But it's scary too, because I think the public, I mean, behind it is the sense that the public's being played somewhat. People don't understand, I think, often, that think tanks that put out position papers, including there's a think tank that going back to Mike Pence that he worked for after his first two congressional runs didn't work out. He went to work for a think tank. They look like they're independent academic groups, but they're actually funded by special interests that are putting out often position papers that are nothing more than lobbying for their interests. You know, so you've got at some point in his career, Mike Pence took a position and argued that tobacco doesn't really kill people. And you know, lo and behold, there seemed to be many financial tobacco ties to the think tank that he'd been working for. And, you know, so it's the public doesn't, you know, without understanding the money, it's hard for people to evaluate the biases. And that money is everywhere.
What started you on the trail to dark money? Because to the book. I mean, what led you to think, okay, there's probably a lot more here that people just aren't aware of?
You know, what got me going on it was actually, you know, as I said, I've been a reporter in Washington, yeah. I think now for, you know, since the Reagan administration. I covered the Reagan White House, actually, for the Wall Street Journal. And what caught my attention was the Tea Party rebellion and the fact that as I was looking at the coverage of it, that there were so many of the slogans and the signs and the costumes were the same all over the country. And so many of the tactics were the same, where they were disrupting town hall meetings where congressmen were coming back to their districts. And it seemed organized rather than a spontaneous combustion. And so I was curious about whether anyone was putting money into trying to organize the thing, and if so, who it was. And my reporting led me to the Koch brothers, who are two of the richest people in the world, brothers who were together worth $98 billion now, and they were under the radar. Their political operatives were helping sort of foment this rebellion. And it's not to say that there aren't really people who believe those things organically and that are Tea Party believers on their own, but they were getting a huge assist from secret big money that wanted to take down Obama. And that's where I came into the story. Like, who are these people who are under the radar, are worth billions and billions, nearly $100 billion, and are quietly, you know, changing the whole political landscape of America?
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jane Mayer. She is a writer for The New Yorker who published perhaps the most comprehensive piece look at Mike Pence's life and career that we have seen so far. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. I'm talking a little bit about the Koch brothers, and if we've got a couple of minutes left before we go to the first break. Could you give thumbnails of where they fit on the ideological spectrum? Because where we're going to go back to this is, you know, Charles and David Koch and Mike Pence aren't the most natural bedfellows. That was the piece, part of your story that really, really intrigued me. Could you talk a bit about who the Koch brothers are and what they believe and what they want out of the system?
Well, sure. I mean, and what they are is kind of far right libertarian zealots. They believe in such small government that as you know, Grover Norquist, who's one of their allies, has said you want to be able to drown it in the bathtub. They believe that business should really run the country. Businesses like their own, Koch Industries, which is a huge fossil fuel company, refines oil and has 4,000 miles of pipeline and that kind of thing. So at any rate, that's what they believe. But being libertarians, they also are not religious. They don't have much in the way of socially conservative views. They've had a kind of a live and let live attitude towards all kinds of moral issues. And so you're right. They're not necessarily allies, particularly of Mike Pence's or, for that matter, of Donald Trump's. And they had gathered a war chest for the 2016 campaign of $889 million that they and their friends were going to try to put into it to win the White House for someone that they could back. And they refused to spend it in the end on any presidential candidate because they didn't like the Republican nominee and that was Trump. So you would think that they wouldn't be much of a factor now. But that wasn't the surprise of the story. Is actually Pence is their guy, according to many people I interviewed, including Steve Bannon, who was the strategic director in the Trump White House. And he said to me, he was afraid that if Pence ever became president, he would be a president owned by the Kochs.
We are talking with Jane Mayer, a New Yorker writer who is the author of the book Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right, and has just done a comprehensive piece on Vice President Mike Pence. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881 or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with Jane Mayer. She's a writer for The New Yorker. Her recent piece about Mike Pence, current vice president and former Indiana governor, is probably the most comprehensive yet published. She's also the author of, among other books, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Before we went to the break, we were talking about where the Koch brothers fit on the political spectrum. They're very libertarian, opposed to just about every form of government regulation, and think that they and business people like them should pretty much be able to operate unfettered. But they're not sort of natural allies of the religious right or social conservatives, which is the part of the ideological spectrum that Mike Pence came from. What brought these folks together? I mean, where was this match made?
In 2009 is when they really came together. By then, Mike Pence was in Congress and in the leadership of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives. And he did a big favor for Koch Industries. I'm not saying that's why he did it, but he certainly came to their attention and carried their water. They were trying to fend off a tax on carbon pollution, on the kind of pollution that creates global warming. And it would have badly hurt their bottom line at Koch Industries. And Mike Pence took up their cause. They'd created a petition to try to get every congressman to sign it, saying they'll spend no money trying to fend off climate change and that they would oppose this carbon tax. And Pence really helped kill that tax. It was moving through the House and then it died in the Senate. And after he really took up their cause, that's when the Kochs invited him to one of their semi-annual fundraising sessions they have. They've got these very secretive conclaves where they invite some of the richest conservatives in the country to kind of meet and greet the candidates that are rising stars on the right and fund them. And that's when Pence got to go to one of those and started to forge this relationship.
There were a lot of people, obviously a lot of Republicans and conservative politicians who were courting the Kochs because, you know, there are even jokes that, that perhaps the most important primary in the Republican presidential nominating process is what they now informally call the Koch primary. Who gets that support? What did Pence do that separated him from the pack? Because there obviously would have been a lot of other people who were willing to help them with their agenda.
Well, you know, while you've described him as a social conservative, he has very much spouted the libertarian economic line. I mean, he's very much taken the position that the Kochs have taken and pushed very hard in this country, that regulations are bad for people and that taxes are, you know, have to be as low as humanly possible, and that government is a force of mostly for evil. And he's really carried that line. He's also a very articulate spokesman for it. He's been a radio host in your state, and he's a good talker. He's affable, likable person, and so you know he was a great salesman for their point of view. And he's also been a skeptic, at least in the past, about climate change, and you know described it as a hoax. I think his position maybe has evolved a little since then. But there was very little space between what he was saying and what the Kochs wanted.
Got an email question from our regular listener, Marion. If you want to join the conversation by email, you can send your email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Marion writes, there are a growing number of earth, animal, and food justice advocates striving to protect our land and animals from agribusiness dictating governmental policies concerning land usage and animal care in Indiana by promoting relentless expansion of livestock operation. Did you find anything out about the influence of Lucas Oil's Protect the Harvest and promoting the nefarious right to farm legislation?
I do not know about that. But, you know, this essential battle between huge corporate interests and the environment is very much the battleground that the Kochs have been playing on and trying to, you know, push back against any. There's growing support in this country, popular support for doing something, for instance, about climate change and many other environmental issues. But the corporate interests are so powerful, it's very hard for people to push back against them. So I don't know about that specific fight, but there are so many of them across the country.
I've gotten a Facebook message from a listener named Deborah who says, it must be noted that Cardinal Tobin and the Catholic Church have very different ideas and spirituality regarding refugees than evangelical Christians. Part of what, as you pointed out, part of in the piece, though, makes it interesting is that Pence did start his life and his faith journey as a Catholic.
Very much so. I mean, he grew up in a very Catholic family in Columbus, Indiana. One of six kids. His mom, who I interviewed, Nancy Pence Fritch, who's a delightful person, is still very much she's a very devout Catholic, as are most of Pence's siblings still. But he broke from the family when he went off to college at Hanover College and converted to evangelical Christianity and started to take a different path from then on out.
We are talking with New Yorker writer Jane Mayer about several things, about her recent profile of former Indiana governor, current Vice President Mike Pence, also her book Dark Money, which explores sort of the hidden world of how undocumented money, massive sums of it, funded the rise of the radical right in this country. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Sajad has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Sajad, did I pronounce your name correctly? Or
Yes, you did.
Oh, thank you. What's on your mind?
You know, I was Jean Mayer mentioned that Vice President Pence was working for a bank at one point.
Oops, it looks like we lost the call. I think where he was going with this is wanted to ask if it's possible to have a democratic process if any candidate is vulnerable to big money.
Well, I mean, I think that there's a quote actually in the beginning of my book, and it's from former Justice Louis Brandeis, who says you can either have huge concentrations of money or you can have democracy, but you can't have both. And for much of American history, we've managed to somehow straddle both. But there is a problem when it gets so unequal in the money that the big money captures the government, and you can see it happening. I mean, look at I'm in Washington, where I see, you know, the heads of all of these regulatory parts of the government seem to be run now by the biggest money interests that are being regulated. I mean, it's a complete capture of the hen house by the biggest possible chickens. So, you know, it can be a real problem, and it is a big problem in this country now. And it's happened before in this country, and there have been waves of reform where the public's kind of rose up and said, you know, fix it. And there have been, you know, campaign finance laws passed. We're at one of those moments, I think, where the public is really getting sick of it. And you saw it in the last election. You saw Bernie Sanders talking about how everything's rigged, and you also saw Donald Trump talking about how everything's rigged. So you've got people on all sides of the ideological spectrum feeling like there's too much money. Every poll shows that. And that the people with most money have too much power. And most Americans want to see it evened out somehow, but they've got to find a mechanism or a reform to back.
I've gotten an email question from a listener named Marcia. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Marcia writes, "Dear Jane, do you think that the total and complete funding of political campaigns from taxpayer public financing will ever be possible? She says, thank you for the light you have shined on dark money."
Well, thank you. You know something, despite writing these books that people tell me are depressing, I'm actually quite optimistic about it because I studied American history in college and after college, and I know that there have been waves of reform before. And so I actually, you know, there's this kind of cycle of corruption and reform. I just don't see why it wouldn't happen again now. So much the country wants to see reform, and public financed elections are actually... The truth is they're happening in various places on the local scale around the country. So some of the most interesting reform is taking place in smaller elections. And what you're seeing is government paid for matching funds so that small donors can match some of the big donors. And it seems to be helping. I think there's going to be change. I really do.
Gotten a question from a listener named Richard via Facebook. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Richard writes, did you spend any time in Indiana during the RFRA debate, and how did it play elsewhere?
So I was not in Indiana during the RFRA debate, but I remember it from where I was, which was in Washington, and it was one of the things that really caught people's eye all around the country about Mike Pence. Everybody, many people saw him do an interview with George Stephanopoulos on ABC TV on a Sunday morning show, and it was, I think, all can pretty much agree. I've talked to a lot of the advisors to Pence. It was a disaster for Pence. He was asked over and over by Stephanopoulos, well, are you saying in Indiana it's now legal to discriminate against homosexuals? And over and over, Pence just tried to wiggle out of answering. And so he looked like he didn't have the you know, his convictions looked, it looked like he was afraid to say what he really thought. And he seemed to be squirming, and it was just not an impressive performance. I think it hurt him a lot, and obviously it hurt him a lot in the state, because one of the most interesting things, and you being in Indiana, most of the listeners there know it better than I do, but the opposition that grew up to Pence that mattered so much was moderate Republican opposition in the business community to him. And that was unsustainable for a Republican governor.
We've gotten a comment rather than a question via Facebook. I'm going to ask, I know there are people, but it speaks to a point here. I'm going to ask if people want to make comments, that they make them brief. This comes from Michael. Again, if you want to reach out to us via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Michael writes, Pence is even more dangerous than Trump with his right-wing bigotry, phony Christianity, and corporate crony capitalism. Unironically, he doesn't seem to mind having poor people in this country die due to lack of health care or go bankrupt because of greedy, fraudulent bankers. But boy, oh boy, don't even think about selling a wedding cake to a gay couple. Pence was a lying, ignorant, racist Hoosier version of Rush Limbaugh in the 90s with his right-wing hate radio program on WIBC, and was possibly the worst most divisive governor in Indiana history. Pence should have been swept into the dustbin of history, and if not for Putin and Russian propaganda, that's where he and Trump would be. When they finally impeach Trump for his crimes, they need to do a twofer and impeach Pence for his lies and treason, too. We could actually have a pretty nice country to live in if not for the corporate fascists and bigots like Pence. The point, question I want to take coming out of Michael's thing is that, as a reporting challenge, was it difficult to find people who did not have strong opinions about Mike Pence one way or the other?
You know, that's a great question. And the truth is almost everybody had really strong opinions about Mike Pence, particularly in Indiana. The kind of parlor game in Washington was who's, you know, who would make a better or a worse president, Mike Pence or Donald Trump? And most people thought that Pence would be, you know, better than Trump in many ways because he's at least had some experience governing. But when I got to Indiana, so many people said to me, oh, my God, are you kidding? Pence would be far worse than Trump. That surprised me. There are a lot of strong feelings about Pence in his home state. And, of course, there's some people who adore him, and including in his hometown of Columbus, and obviously his mom and his brother, Greg, who I also spoke with. And there are others. But he was not considered a successful governor, even by many Republicans. I'm not sure he would have gotten reelected. That's what I'm going on the reporting I was getting. I mean, there were an awful lot of people who were telling me he would not have been reelected as governor, and that it was a salvation mission that got him onto that vice presidential ticket. And even some of the people in the Trump campaign thought that was true, that they were just saving his neck.
We are talking with Jane Mayer, a New Yorker writer who is the author of the book Dark Money and, more recently, a comprehensive profile of Mike Pence. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Ron has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ron, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you, John.
Certainly.
I'd like to take the opportunity to thank your guest for her research and her books. I hope this is insightful for a lot of people that, I've known a lot of people over the years that just didn't believe that these kind of things go on, the money involved. I've always tend to be a conspiracy theorist and believe that if the facts line up, it's no longer a theory. I hope your guest lives. I pray that she lives long and prospers. The research that she's doing and the facts that she's laying out there. I guess that's it. The only other thing I don't like to, if he's listening, admonish Mike Pence that he, Christians are told to care for God's creation, and he's definitely not doing that. So he may want to consider his position there. Thank you much, John.
Thanks very much for the call, Ron. Take care.
Sure.
It's interesting because there is actually a Christian environmental movement that's, mm-hmm. you know, very strong. And so, it could be interpreted both ways. There are some who think that this opposition to climate change that some on the right have is, you know, or to saying that it is real is not a Christian position. It's being fought out there. Anyway, thank you. I appreciate it. And I do think the money matters a lot. Those huge backers, when they give that much money, there are usually some strings attached.
We've in that spirit, we've also gotten a listener who did not want to go on the air. Just wanted to say that your New Yorker article is wonderful, and she wanted to thank you for being on WFYI, says this is why she listens to this station. I guess I'd broaden that into a real quick question. What was the feedback to the piece?
Well, you know, I mean, I got a lot of really great feedback from our readers, but Pence's own office in the vice presidential office, they were angry about it, and they particularly took issue with one or two anecdotes that they thought were not fair. And so I had to deal with that. I think they called it fiction. But my husband, who's a reporter too, said, well, welcome to the fake news club. it's almost like an affirmation that you got it right.
Yes. We are talking with Jane Mayer, a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker. You're listening to No Limits. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with Jane Mayer. She's a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and the author of several books, including, most recently, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. She also just did perhaps the most comprehensive look at the life and career of Mike Pence for The New Yorker. We are talking with her, and one of the parlor games here in Indiana, you talked about the parlor games in D.C. about asking, you know, who would be better as president or worse, Mike Pence or Donald Trump. One of the things we're sort of asking is how much influence he has within the Trump administration. We've noticed, for example, that since Trump was elected, particularly in health care, that Washington's been filling up with Hoosiers in positions to influence health care policy, Seema Verma at CMS and Jerome Adams at the Surgeon General's office, and just yesterday, former Lilly executive Alex Azar, who's been nominated to replace Tom Price. Are all these Indiana transplants just a coincidence, or is there a Pence connection? And how much does the lasting impression of Pence's HIP 2.0 play a role in these nominations?
I think Pence has had quite a big influence on personnel in particular. Remember, he was in charge of the transition project when after Trump was elected. And you can see a number of his picks, the ones that you've mentioned. I think he was also close with Price, the former head of the FHHS. And he's been a longtime friend of Betsy DeVos, who's the education secretary, and is close with. You'll see a number of the appointments are people who the Kochs wanted again, and that we were talking about the Koch brother influence. Well, it appears that they worked through Pence to get a number of their people sprinkled all around to the government, and a lot of them are people who have both Pence and Koch connections. So. I think that's one area where he's had influence. It's very hard to say, though, if anyone has much influence over Trump, because he doesn't seem to take direction too much from anyone. I interviewed, among other people, Newt Gingrich, who claimed that Pence was among the most powerful people in the Trump administration, one of the three or four most, and because he's in all the meetings. He's in the national security meetings and in the domestic policy meetings, and he's someone who Trump is said to like. But what's his, what are the fingerprints? Where do you see the policy positions that he has taken that Trump has followed? And it's very hard to find that because, again, I people that I've been interviewing don't seem to think that Trump is a big listener when it comes to taking direction.
We are talking with New Yorker writer Jane Mayer. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Dee has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Dee, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My question goes back to the presidential campaign where one of the slogans was drain the swamp. And your earlier comments, Ms. Mayer, about the moneyed interests in D.C., why hasn't this administration drained the swamp and, in my opinion, just really added to it? And I'll take my answer offline.
Thanks very much for the call, Dee.
Well, that was one of my questions as well when I started into this story. How did someone who was an outsider like Trump, who claimed that he was going to try to rid Washington of corruption, end up with administration that seems, in many ways, among the most corrupt we've seen? And, you know, the answer really is that Trump was... He had no experience, you got to remember. He didn't know even who to put in power. So who did he turn to for advice? Well, he turned it to, among other people, Mike Pence, who was very much, very close with a lot of the huge corporate interests, including the Koch brothers and others. And they helped sort of slide all these people in who have great vested interests all over the current administration. I think it's one of the reasons that Trump campaigned as a kind of a populist, but he's governing really as a corporatist.
I've gotten an email from a listener named Randy, and if you want to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Randy writes, which PACs and organizations does Pence show allegiance to the most? Is he already planning on running for president?
Well, he has started his own, actually, which is unusual for a vice president so early on in administration. Usually they don't start raising their own money until it's close to the end, and they may be running for office themselves for the White House. So he's got his own PAC. You can look it up online. And he is very much being supported again by some of the major groups that the Kochs fund. Americans for Prosperity is probably their most familiar one. It has a branch in Indiana. The Christian conservatives have also been big supporters of his, and any group that they're funding is also pushing for him. So I most people think, and in fact, again, Newt Gingrich, who I interviewed, said that they expect that Pence will eventually run for the White House himself. And Gingrich said he thought that Pence will be, you know, first in line on the Republican side in the future. I think, you know, that somewhat depends how the Trump administration goes. If it goes well, that might certainly be true. But if it you know, blows up in some direction, I think it's going to hurt Pence also.
Got a question from a listener named David via Facebook. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. David writes, fascinating program. Thank you for having Jane on the show. Would she compare and contrast the Kochs, the Walmart family, and others with the 1800s robber steel railroad barons?
Very much so. I mean, and that was a period of great corruption, the Gilded Age, when mm-hmm. suddenly there was really the rise of economic inequality in the country that's on the level of what we've got now. And in most other parts of the history, there really hasn't been this level of economic inequality. And so it's not surprising. When you get that much concentrated wealth in the hands of a few, inevitably they're going to try to use it to elect people to office who serve their interests. Because they can, you know, they've got that kind of imbalance of power. And so it's very much like the robber baron era, I think, the Gilded Age. And what's interesting about the Kochs, who, you know, I spent a lot of time trying to understand them, and is that they view the Gilded Age and the robber barons as the good times.
Yeah.
When they taught history themselves and learned it, they had their own school called the Freedom School, and they taught that the robber barons were the good guys and the reformers were the bad guys. So they see it in a very different light.
We've gotten a couple of questions about via email. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org about ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and its role, whether your reporting and research had taken you in that direction. I know because I've read the book that there's a pretty good look at it in Dark Money. But what did you learn about ALEC?
Yeah, ALEC is very important because what ALEC is the American Legislative Exchange Council, is an organization that was set up when so many of these other corporate-funded front groups were set up, which really began in the late 1970s and kind of got really off the ground in the 80s. And what ALEC does is it operates at the state level. And one of the things that's been very smart about the Kochs and other conservatives is that they haven't just tried to change American politics at the federal level in Washington. They've really put a big amount of pressure on state legislatures. And ALEC is it's sometimes called a mill bill. Corporations belong to it. Business people give money to it. They write sort of blueprints for legislation, and the legislators then take those blueprints and turn them into laws. I mean, it's almost like a factory for corporate legislation. And it was partly funded by the Kochs and other conservatives back in, you know, a couple decades ago when they were really thinking about, I mean, back up what this is really about is they were feeling in the 70s that corporate power was waning and there was too much of an environmental movement and too much of a consumer movement and the Vietnam War was raging and they were afraid that business was losing power. So they pretty much got organized in the 70s and started all these groups that have now kind of come to really be major power centers in the country and explain a lot about why our politics is the way it is.
We are talking with Jane Mayer, longtime New Yorker staff writer. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Peter has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Peter, you're on the air.
Thank you, John, for what you do for us. Ms. Mayer, thank you for your writing and your research. Where do you think the Robert Mueller investigation will go? Where will his findings be reported out to? And would you put down $1,000 that Trump will be impeached, forced to resign, be charged with high crimes and misdemeanors, and frankly, possibly charged with treason? And I'll take your answers offline.
Thank you very much for the call, Peter.
Well, I can promise you as a reporter, which is not in one of the most top bracket pay categories, I'm not putting $1,000 down on anything except my kids' tuition. No, I don't really know. You know, I've been somewhat on the fence about what to believe about how serious and important the collusion is, does it exist between the Trump campaign and Russia. And I have to say, as time's gone by, I've gotten more convinced that there seems to be something serious there. I know Mueller a little bit from reporting, and I have great respect for him. I think he's a real public servant with no particular axe to grind. If there's something there, I feel that he would get to the bottom of it. And, every day there seems to be another revelation. It's kind of shocking. And I do think, from what I've read, that if nothing else, that this whole issue of outside manipulation of our social media and political process in the country is something that we really got to think about and take seriously. It was a mess in 2016, and we really got to kind of take some precautions to keep our politics from being manipulated the way they have been manipulated in many other places around the world.
We've got a couple of questions via Facebook that are related and connect with Pence. They come from Kathy and Ty. Again, if you want to join the conversation on Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Kathy wants to know if there's any evidence of Pence having connections with Russians while on the transition team, and are there any connections between the Kochs and Russians? And Ty wants to know about whether you believe Pence had knowledge of Mike Flynn's conflict of interest.
So these are all, somewhat related. Taking the Mike Flynn issue, I mean, what you had was Pence was in charge of the transition, and there was a Democratic congressman, Elijah Cummings, who sent a letter over saying that Flynn had conflicts of interest, that he was representing foreign interests, and they were serious and needed to be looked into. That I interviewed Cummings. He got a response from somebody in the transition saying, we'll look into it, but Pence said he never heard about it. It's impossible to know if nobody ever told him. He says he didn't hear about it. It's possible that he didn't hear about it, but then you have to wonder, why didn't he hear about it? You know, what kind of job was he doing running this transition if he wasn't vetting the future national security advisor, which was one of the most sensitive and important positions in the United States government? And hearing from a note from a congressman doesn't reach him about it. So either way, I think it raises a lot of troubling questions about his performance in terms of that. The question about what he might know about Russians or his contact with Russians, you know, all along the way, he has pretty much poo-pooed the whole idea of the Russian connections, and even up to saying, you know, that there was no contact between the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks. He said something like, nothing could be further from the truth. But just today, we see that there were actually emails going back and forth between WikiLeaks and Donald Trump Jr. And so once again, the question is, did Mike Pence just not know, or did he know, and is he not telling the truth? And you know, it's impossible to know what the answer is there. My guess, according to his office, they say he didn't know. And when he came out with that sort of big, strong denial, he actually didn't know that on that same day that Don Jr. was corresponding with WikiLeaks. But then you have to, again, there are more questions that come from something like that. If he didn't know, why didn't someone tell him after he made that statement, that unequivocal denial? And is he mad now to learn that, in fact, he was out there telling a lie? And if so, is he going to, you know, express that to someone? I mean, there's kind of a cavalier attitude towards misleading the public here. There have been these serial misrepresentations from Mike Pence. And if so, I mean, I think he owes it to the public to explain what's going on.
We've gotten a couple of emails from listeners named Gail and Thomas, basically asking, is there a Democratic equivalent of the dark money, the Kochs? Are there any organizations set up on that side of the equation?
And there definitely is. Big money and dark money is a bipartisan issue. There's, you know, big money is a problem on all sides, really. And there's a group called Democracy Alliance that is a bunch of the Democratic billionaires and multi-multimillionaires that get together, and they too kind of cover their tracks and don't tell you what they're doing. And, you know, it's kind of secretive about how they're spending their money. It's not exactly equivalent, but there certainly are efforts like that. I mean, the person who I get asked about over and over again, because the conservatives, you know, answer every time you mention the Koch brothers, is to say, what about George Soros?
And
I have written about George Soros at great length also. It's not just that I've written about the Koch brothers, but Soros, his big issue is transparency. So he's pretty upfront about his spending in comparison with the Kochs, who really, the Kochs had a family motto, which was, it's when the whale spouts that it gets harpooned. And so they all decided, we're going to stay underwater. And that's a very different mindset than Soros has. But, you know, I think Soros has spent an alarming amount of money to get his way in politics, too. And whoever's spending it, I'd like to see this country in a position where it's one man, one vote, and people are politically equal despite how much money they do or don't have.
We've got just a little bit of time left. What's next for you? I mean, are you continuing on the Pence beat, or are you moving on to something else now?
You know, I'm based in Washington for The New Yorker, and I cover politics. And right now, that means mostly covering Trump administration, you know, politics. It's mind-boggling. I've been here since, as I said, since the Reagan administration. I have never seen anything like what's going on in Washington now. So it's keeping me pretty busy.
I've got a huge backlog of questions here for you. So I guess if your travels and your reporting does bring you back to Indiana, I hope you will come back on the program again. Clearly, our listeners really want to talk with you and value what you have to say. And I'm really grateful to you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Well, John, you've been wonderful. You were a huge help when I was in Indiana. And thank you to all the other Hoosiers who helped me understand your political situation.
Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.